Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. British Prime Minister Theresa May has given Russia until the end of Tuesday to explain the use of a nerve agent against a former Russian double agent, Sergei Skripal, in southern England. London said it's highly likely the Kremlin was involved. Ms. May addressed Parliament Monday.
It is now clear that Mr. Skripal and his daughter were poisoned with a military-grade nerve agent of a type developed by Russia. This is part of a group of nerve agents known as Novichok.
She said there are only two possible explanations for what occurred March 4 in the city of Salisbury.
Either this was a direct act by the Russian state against our country, or the Russian government lost control of its potentially catastrophically damaging nerve agent and allowed it to get into the hands of others.
The Prime Minister said she's prepared to conclude the action amounts to an unlawful use of force by the Russian state against the United Kingdom. The White House expressed outrage. Moscow rejected the accusation. Dmitry Peskov, spokesman for President Vladimir Putin, said Skripal worked for British intelligence. The incident took place on British soil and has nothing to do with Russia. Skripal and his daughter remain hospitalized since the incident in critical condition. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, during a brief stop in Nigeria Monday, met with President Muhammadu Buhari, promising help in the fight against the Boko Haram insurgency.
The recent kidnapping of more than 100 schoolgirls is heartbreaking. Nigeria has the United States' full support, and we are actively working with our partners here on other ways we can assist you in this fight.
More than 100 schoolgirls were taken from the town of Dapchi in Yobe State last month. Tillerson stopped in five countries, including Ethiopia, Djibouti, Kenya, and Chad. This is VOA News. As fighting in Syria rages, U.S. UN Ambassador Nikki Haley Monday told the Security Council the U.S. is prepared to act if the Council fails to. She said the Council's demand for a ceasefire has failed and the plight of people in eastern Ghouta is dire.
We have drafted a new ceasefire resolution that provides no room for evasion. It is simple, straightforward, and binding. It will take effect immediately upon adoption by this Council. It contains no counterterrorism loopholes for Assad, Iran, and the Russians to hide behind.
The death toll from the government's three-week assault on eastern Ghouta approaches 1,200 as the forces of President Bashar al-Assad seek to crush rebel resistance and end the firing of missiles into nearby Damascus. Meanwhile, the Associated Press reports thousands are fleeing advancing Turkish and rebel forces in northwest Afrin, fearing atrocities. The White House said even though it hasn't heard back yet from North Korea, it expects a proposed meeting between President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un to take place. Sarah Huckabee Sanders is a presidential spokesperson.
We fully expect that it will. The offer was made and we've accepted. North Korea made several promises and we hope that they stick to those promises. And if so, the meeting will go on as planned.
Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said he expects to hear something soon directly from Pyongyang. Vice President Mike Pence, in a televised interview Monday, said Mr. Kim's offer to cease missile and nuclear testing, while not objecting to joint U.S.-South Korean military exercises, is, in his words, a remarkable step forward, the result of the maximum pressure campaign on Pyongyang. At least 49 of 71 people aboard a U.S. Bangla Airlines Bombardier Q400 aircraft were killed Monday when their plane crashed in bad weather during approach to the airport in the Nepalese capital, Kathmandu. The aircraft, on a flight from Dhaka, clipped a fence and burst into flames. Most of the passengers were from Nepal and Bangladesh. The White House Monday announced President Trump will host talks next week with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The heir apparent to King Salman is scheduled to visit the White House March 20. It is the Saudi Crown Prince's first foreign trip that also includes stops in Egypt and Britain. A U.S. congressional panel Monday said after completing a number of interviews into Russia's interference in the 2016 election, it found no collusion between the Trump campaign and Moscow to influence the outcome. Committee Democrats had no immediate reaction. Russia denies the meddling allegations. President Trump Monday blocked Singapore-based Broadcom's $117 billion hostile bid to take over U.S.-based Qualcomm, citing national security concerns. Meanwhile, U.S. stocks closed mixed with the NASDAQ composite, which tracks the technology sector, rising to a second straight record high, closing at 75.88. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, the 13th day of March, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Zambia's main opposition says it welcomes a Commonwealth-initiated national political dialogue.
We have said that Zambia has basically gone back to dictatorship, and we want to restore democracy in Zambia. We want to restore the rule of law. We want people to regain their rights of assembly, the rights of association.
Charles Kakoma is the spokesman for Zambia's main opposition UPND party. A spokesman for Zimbabwe's newly formed political party will discuss the party's chances in the coming election. South Sudan's media authority suspends a UN-operated FM radio station, and Ivory Coast 2020 election has a new presidential candidate.
The reason I want to be president, it is twofold. My country needs some change. We need a new leadership in Cote d'Ivoire, because for more than 24 years, since Ofubonyi has been gone, Cote d'Ivoire has no peace.
David Bani is the president of the Progressive Patriotic Party of Ivory Coast, and we'll get analysis of DRC's new mining law. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Zambia's main opposition, United Party for National Development, UPND, says it welcomes a national political dialogue initiated by the Commonwealth Special Envoy to Zambia, Ibrahim Gambari. It is aimed to resolve political tensions by promoting peace, national cohesion, political tolerance, and reconciliation in Zambia. Local media quoted Gambari as saying all stakeholders and representatives of the international community will be invited to witness the launch of the steering committee. Zambians have expressed concern about politically motivated violence as supporters of both the ruling Patriotic Front PF party and the main opposition UPND trade accusations of attacking each other. Charles Kakoma, the spokesman for the UPND, tells viewers Peter Clotty the dialogue will ensure the fundamental rights of the citizens are protected.
We are in full support of the dialogue process initiated by the Commonwealth, and we are happy that finally the special envoy has announced plans to establish the steering committee. We have been concerned that from last year, when the Commonwealth dialogue process was initiated, nothing has been taking place, and that was worrying. Now that the special envoy has taken this initiative, we are happy that things will begin to work. The talks will begin in earnest.
What is the expectation of the UPND in these anticipated talks?
We have said that Zambia has basically gone back to dictatorship, and we want to restore democracy in Zambia. We want to restore the rule of law. We want people to regain their lost fundamental rights, the rights of assembly, the rights of association, the rights of expression, media freedoms, and to stop the violation of people's human rights, to restore the rule of law, and to help society get back to normal. Right now, there are a lot of people that are in prison. They are political prisoners. We want them to be released. There is no reason why they are holding them in prison. Others have fled the country for fear of being victimized or arrested. So everything is not normal. We have a situation, a flawed electoral system. We want the electoral system to be reformed, to reflect, to have an independent electoral commission that will ensure that there are free, fair, and credible elections in Zambia whenever they are held. We have constitutional and institutional problems to be sorted out, including issues dealing with the Constitutional Court, which messed up in the past over the presidential expedition. All those have to be discussed.
Some Zambians are blaming both the ruling party and the opposition and other stakeholders for not being able to find a solution to Zambia's internal problems, waiting for an external organization like the Commonwealth to engineer these talks.
Well, first of all, the ruling party instilled fear in the Zambian people so that they could not talk, they could not rise, and whoever was voicing out of being arrested or intimidated. And even when things became very bad with the arrest of the UPND president, Hakainde Hichilema, most of the people in the country just went silent. They were scared to talk. Of course, we had grave institutions like the Catholic Church and other churches speaking out, and those were a few voices. But the rest of the institutions went quiet until the Commonwealth stepped in, because we had to ask people in the international community, in this global village, to help out with the situation in Zambia. And the Commonwealth heard our cry, and they stepped in. There's nothing wrong with that. The world can always help in a situation where the local people need help. There's nothing wrong with helping others.
What would be the next line of action for the UPND in anticipation of this talks that is scheduled to begin either at the end of the month or early next month?
Well, what is now happening is just preparatory work. For example, finding people to sit on the steering committee and the other committees that are being formed to help with the negotiations and participate in the dialogue process. That is what is happening now. And by 26th of March, when the steering committee will be launched, we should be prepared and ready to begin the talks.
Charles Kakoma is the spokesman for Zambia's main opposition, United Party for National Development. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty from the capital, Lusaka. Former Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe's name will not be on the ballot this year, but he is likely to influence this year's election, expected between July and August. Sebastian Mofu in Harare talked to Jealousy Mawarere, the spokesman of the newly formed National Patriotic Front Party. It is largely composed of people fired from the ruling ZANU-PF party after Mr. Mugabe was forced to resign by the army last November. Mawarere says the new party's candidate, Ambrose Mutiniri, will defeat President Emmerson Mnangagwa.
We have set out a strategy to end both the urban and the rural vote. We have a candidate who is appealing both in Mashonaland provinces and in Matabeleland. And he's someone who has been there for a long time. He's also experienced as an ambassador, and he was also a cabinet minister and a resident minister for Mashonaland East. So we are talking of someone who has been in politics since he was 16. But notwithstanding that, we have also gotten endorsement from one of the most popular politicians in this country, President Robert Mugabe. He has said, for as long as you are doing the right thing, I will support you.
What is the right thing?
The right thing is returning the country to constitutionalism, returning the country to the rule by the people, and to ensure that the gun doesn't determine the politics of the country. And he said, if you also ensure that NPF is a platform for youth participation in electoral politics, then he will give his nod towards our project.
We have President Emmerson Mnangagwa leading Zimbabwe now. He says he didn't come through the bullet. What do you think?
It's funny to say that he didn't come through the bullet when we know for sure that on the 14th of November last year, military tanks were moved from Darendel and they were used to block the streets of Harare. And we know for sure that the so-called command element of the Zimbabwe Defense Forces, when they met with then-President Robert Mugabe, they had demands after they had put him under house arrest and announced on national television that they've taken over. They had demands, and they listed their demands and said they were intervening in order to avert an imminent electoral defeat for ZANU-PF, and that they were also taking over power because President Mugabe wanted to terminate their contracts of employment, among other five reasons that they listed for the coup. But among those, there was nothing to do with the concerns that the generality of the Zimbabwean people have. So it's very clear that what happened was a coup, and the coup announcer himself said that on national television, that they've taken over and that and they chased away government ministers. So it is very clear, if it swims like a duck, quacks like a duck, it's a duck. So it's a coup.
Mr. Mugabe, what does he want happen to Zimbabwe, which he could not have done in the past 37 years?
I think President Mugabe has done quite a lot of things for Zimbabweans. Black empowerment, the land redistribution exercise. And you would see that towards the end of his reign, he announced unequivocally that this was the time for the youth to take over, to incorporate the young generation into the governance of the country. And those are the things that he's passionate about. Black empowerment, resource ownership, value addition of our resources, industrialization. Those are the things that that he was advocating for. But thanks for the coup, we now know who were the saboteurs within his administration, because immediately after they assumed power, they cancelled the Australian contract that President Mugabe's administration had sought, which sought to purify platinum here. It was worth $200 million, and it was given to a company called Kelnec, and that was cancelled. And President Mugabe had also ensured that anyone who mined platinum and wanted to export raw platinum had to pay a 15% levy to the government. It was punitive in order to force the companies to refine the platinum here. But what did ED do? Immediately as he got in, he scrapped that, he reduced it to 5%. But the reason is that he's also involved in platinum mining.
Jealousy Mawereri is the spokesman for the newly formed National Patriotic Front Party of Zimbabwe. He was speaking with Sebastian Mofu from Harare. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Tuesday, March 13th. Daybreak Africa time is now 16 minutes past the hour. Presidential elections in Ivory Coast are not until October 31st, 2020. But already, candidates are lining up to succeed President Alassane Ouattara, who has announced he will not run again at the end of his second term. One of the early presidential candidates, David Bani, the leader of the Progressive Patriotic Party of Ivory Coast, he says he's running to be president because he wants to bring about change to Cote d'Ivoire.
The reason I want to be president, it is twofold. My country needs some change. We need a new leadership in Cote d'Ivoire because for more than 24 years since Oufou-Boigny has been gone, Cote d'Ivoire has no peace at every level. Education is down, job is down at every level. Even people don't have the power, the means to eat the 3 meals a day. So for some of these reasons, yes, I want to be president to change things.
Why do you think it's you that can bring about the change?
Thank you. I heard that question before from the news media in Cote d'Ivoire. And for the few reasons I just cited, for the past 24 years, we don't have peace in Cote d'Ivoire. And my party wants to bring peace.
Now, we have political parties already in Cote d'Ivoire. And you are here in the United States. What are your chances that you can win the presidency in Cote d'Ivoire with two major political parties already there?
Yes, that's a good question, because in the constitution of my party, we outline what we call our contract with the people. Because right now in Cote d'Ivoire, people are so fed up because the insecurity is scary. People want some change. There are a lot of parties in Cote d'Ivoire. Unfortunately, you don't hear them denouncing what's going on in Cote d'Ivoire. They may have their reason, but from what we know, there is no freedom of speech anymore in Cote d'Ivoire. If you are a party or somebody denouncing what's going on, you end up in jail or dead. That's the truth.
You mentioned Cote d'Ivoire has not known peace for a while, and that is a true statement. How do you think peace can come about? Because you have currently the party of the former president, Laurent Gbagbo, always accusing President Ouattara of trying to further divide the country, of trying to push being behind the former president being sent to the ICC. And as a result, there's a division. How do you bring about this unity or this peace that you talk about? What would you do?
You are right. In my party, we have this thinking, a new era for a new thinking. And Ivorians today agree about one thing, even if they don't say it. We got to walk away. Some people may not like what I'm saying, but it is the truth. If we want peace in Ivory Coast, we need to walk away from Gbagbo, from Bédié, from Ouattara, from Soro. All those people need to retire from politics if we want peace in Ivory Coast. That's one thing. And secondly, we need a national conference for reconciliation, because a lot of things happened in 2011 and Ivory Coast is divided. People from the north don't feel friendly or don't feel comfortable with people from the west. I mean, on both ways, either in the south, either in the north, but it is a complete, I cannot call it division everywhere. So we need a national conference to clear what happened for the last 24 years. And after that, we can talk about peace in Cote d'Ivoire.
Economically, Cote d'Ivoire was one of the countries in Africa that were doing well. Well, lately, the economy has not been doing well. What would you do to bring about, say, jobs in Cote d'Ivoire or to improve the economy of the country?
Yes, you are right. Cote d'Ivoire used to be called the United States of Africa because we were doing well at that time. Every country where there were trouble, you find a place in Cote d'Ivoire to live. But today, things have changed. Things have changed because our leaders, they don't communicate with the people. There is a disconnection between the government and the people. And what we will do is to get people involved in what we do. Meaning, if we have to take a decision about Ivorian, we're going to get them involved. And also, we can do what Ufobain was doing. When Ufobain was on power, he didn't use oil. He didn't use diamond or gold we have now. He developed the agriculture. And that's what we can do today to put Africa back where we were. Even though, like you mentioned rightfully, we have cocoa, we have coffee, we have so many things we can develop.
Corruption is a big question for every country. It seems to me everybody who has tried, they have failed. What would you do?
We can fight corruption. My background is law. It's like in the justice system, you can find people who are corrupted and you can find judges who are right, who can stand by the law to do the right thing. If we start to put in prison those who cause corruption, if we start to put 2-3 people in prison, it's going to change things. But right now in Cote d'Ivoire, and other countries where the corruption is like a cancer, nobody does nothing. But if we punish, if we apply the law in the book, corruption, I'm not saying that it's going to disappear completely, but it's going to be reduced.
David Bani is the president of the Progressive Patriotic Party of Ivory Coast. He was speaking with me here in our Washington studio. South Sudan's media authority last week ordered the suspension of the UN-operated radio Maraya's FM frequency. But as IMBO reports, an agreement signed by the government and the UN mission in South Sudan in 2011 could have jurisdiction over the matter.
The Media Authority was created 2 years ago as an independent body, free from the influence or pressure of the executive branch, and meant to be a force to expand press freedoms. It was part of the media bills of 2008, which included progressive ideas that could push for press freedoms in South Sudan. But those ideas have been replaced by suppression of the press, according to Brian Adeba, deputy director of policy at the Enough Project.
What you see right now is a very watered-down version of the bill and the structures that were formed as a result of what was tabled. And it's very sad to see that the structures that were envisaged in the bill, instead of being instruments of enhancing free expression, have become instruments for muzzling media freedom in South Sudan.
South Sudan's media authority has threatened to ban Radio Maraya because of non-compliance and refusal to be regulated under the media laws in the Republic of South Sudan. There is another agreement that determines what UDMIS and thereby its broadcast programs like Radio Maraya can and can't do. In 2011, the United Nations Mission in South Sudan signed the Status of Forces Agreement, or SOFA, with the government. The agreement defined the role of UDMIS and also granted its right to establish, install, and operate the UN radio station under its exclusive control to broadcast in South Sudan. Brian Adeba says the SOFA agreement granted UDMIS exclusive editorial control over their broadcasts, barring any censorship from the government.
That agreement actually bars any sort of regulation on Maraya by the government in terms of content, in terms of licensing, in terms of fees. So the agreement itself allows for a latitude of freedom for Maraya FM and the UN to run Radio Maraya as it wishes. So if you really want to regulate Radio Maraya, you have to go back to the Status of Forces Agreement. This is an international agreement.
As a result, Adeba says, the independence of those institutions were greatly reduced so that President Kiir has much more say in how the media authority conducts its work. The media authority is supposed to oversee the media industry in terms of regulation, media development, and the issuance of broadcast licenses. In a press release issued by UNESCO in February 2016, the UN body said the media authority is expected to contribute to a vibrant, independent, and pluralistic media in South Sudan by curbing the increased rate of incidents affecting journalists and impunity on crimes against journalists, as well as create an enabling environment for the media to operate in. But Adeba says it's not done that, and instead, South Sudanese operate in an atmosphere of fear.
Where were our parliamentarians when this was happening? No one was speaking up. And guess what? It came back to bite the people of South Sudan. It's biting them right now.
Adeba says when the media bills were tabled for years, Ayan Dangbuor, VOA News, Washington.
A new law signed last week by Democratic Republic of Congo's President Joseph Kabila could leave the country's mining sector open to corruption, according to the London-based Global Witness. The group says that although the new law does increase taxes and royalties, these changes may lead to objections from international mining companies. In response, the DRC government says it will look at all concerns on a case-by-case basis. This, along with a failure to address the conflict of interest provision, means officials could use the mineral wealth for personal gain. Global Witness's campaigner Natasha White tells Ricky Stryak.
In reaction to the industry's concerns, the president's office has said it will continue dialogue with the companies over measures to implement the code, and the mines minister said it would continue to address concerns on a case-by-case basis. Now, Global Witness is concerned that by addressing companies' concerns on a case-by-case basis, it opens the door to corrupt deals that are not transparent. It's our view that such issues, that the law should be applied equally to all operators and that nothing should be conducted behind closed doors.
With the overall raise in taxes, is this not in some ways a better deal for the Congolese people who need roads, hospitals, schools, etc.?
Yeah, we'd say that Congo has full right to try to capitalize on the cobalt boom. However, it's all very well raising taxes and royalties, but our research has shown in the past that there's serious gaps in revenue collection. So until those gaps are closed and what the companies pay into the state accounts ends up in the treasury, there's a concern that greater hiking the royalties and increasing taxes won't necessarily translate into greater revenues for the state.
What kind of problems does Global Witness see with the law's conflict of interest provision? Because I know in your release you said that does not change, and there are issues with the conflict of interest provision as it stands now.
Yeah, exactly. So over the past few years, Global Witness has been issuing recommendations to the government to strengthen its conflict of interest provision. In the new law, the conflict of interest provision remains unchanged, which means that there's nothing in the law to prevent corrupt public officials or members of, for example, the Congolese army or the security forces from abusing their position for private gain in the mineral sector. So this means that such individuals can continue to hold, for example, industrial mining rights as long as they do so via a company. Now, our concern there is that those individuals will use their position, their public office, to profit personally from the mining sector. I think we basically have three main points. It's all very well hiking the royalties and taxes, but until there's proof that the taxes that are paid into government accounts end up with the treasury, that may do little to pull the country's population out of poverty. Second, the conflict of interest provision, which remains largely unchanged, is problematic to us because there's nothing in the law that will prevent members of the security forces or senior public officials from holding industrial mining rights as long as they do so via a company. So there's a concern there that they'll abuse their position for public gain. And then thirdly, there are transparency provisions in the new law, which we feel are progressive. However, they remain very vague. So it's yet to be seen how they will be translated through the rules that are going to be put into place over the coming weeks.
That was Global Witness campaigner Natasha White. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from London. And that is it for this Tuesday, March 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Dave Magnus. I'm James Butte in Washington. Have a lovely day, Africa.
Interested in deeper analysis of news and events in Africa?
Then, plan to join me, Douglas Impuga, on Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. So plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.